I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A terrific book published this year is the memoir from Aaron Williams, The Last Logging Show, A Forestry Family at the End of an Era. A few years ago, just out of university, Aaron takes a job in the logging industry, where both his father and grandfather worked. His great-grandfather built trestles in the 1920s. So perhaps it was inevitable that Aaron would get into forestry, but he was getting into it at a time when there were a lot of changes, thanks to forest practices as well as technology. I'll ask Aaron about what he's chronicled in this book, not just his time, but the end of his father's time in the industry. The book takes us to Haida Gwaii and illustrates how spectacular a place it is. As well, we meet some memorable characters, people that Mr. Williams hasn't forgotten and which color his memories of the hard, often dangerous work. He's a terrific storyteller, as you'll read in the book and hear shortly. Aaron Williams has been published in newspapers like the Globe and Mail and the Halifax Chronicle Herald. He has an MFA in creative nonfiction writing from King's College. His first book, Chasing Smoke, was based on his experience fighting forest fires through the Pacific Northwest, as well as Idaho, Alberta, Ontario, and Quebec. The Last Logging Show is from Harbor Publishing. We spoke in June with Aaron joining me from Halifax. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Aaron Williams. Mr. Williams, good morning.
Hi there, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Good.
I enjoyed this book a great deal, and it's fascinating. As I started the book, to read about your family's history with forestry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just you. Obviously, have had some history with it. Your dad, your grandfather, but this goes back to you had a grandmother as well, and a great grandfather. In the 20s, he built the trestles. So I guess the thing that I was wondering as I was starting the book was it inevitable that you'd end up in this business, say, in this line of work?
I kind of, yeah. Like, I think, I mean, to, like, expand on, like, the intro bit, like, yeah, my parents, they, as I was growing up, they were sort of like, yeah, keep your options open and you can do whatever you want and this kind of thing. Like, they were encouraging, but, like, I was kind of, you know, I don't think too many teenagers know what they want to do. And so I think that it's not uncommon for a teenager who doesn't know what they want to do is, oh, well, mom did this or dad does this. So I guess, you know, you just sort of find yourself in that line of work. And I did for a short time anyway.
Yeah.
And then pretty quickly, I was like, ooh, this is like, the time for this has passed.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful scene in the prologue where you're talking to your dad, and I guess this was this just after high school that you found yourself?
Yeah, what happened was I broke my leg at the end of grade 12.
Uh-huh.
So I couldn't really work the summer after grade 12, so it was in September, so I was kind of bumming around the house for a couple months until I could go to work.
Yeah, and then so you say that you're not sure if you want to go into this kind of work, and he says very, as I said, it's a beautiful scene. Of course you don't. You shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
And you can take that two different ways. Maybe he doesn't see his work for you, or, as you said just a second ago, that the time has passed for this sort of work.
Yeah, and I should be careful in saying that, because there's obviously people still logging and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot tougher than it used to be. You know, the in the interior, the hours are really nasty. It's not as appealing as it once was. Even demographically, like, there weren't really many young people, especially out on the coast in a camp like that.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, looking back, he didn't say, like, you shouldn't do this with a real disdain for it overall, but it was sort of like, well, yeah, like, go try something else out at least, you know?
Yeah. So as the book continues, we see you working and talking to the people that work in this industry. And we get a marvelous sense of what it's like to fell a tree. And as we follow through the book, we see where these things end up, where these logs end up, and places like here in Vancouver, and who buys them, and what they do with them. When you write about this industry, as you do in the book, you write not just about the people, but you also write about the work that they do and why they do it. I guess that was very important for you to do that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I felt like, especially with some of the older guys, like that some of that, there will always be logging in some form, but the way it's done out where my dad's working is getting more and more rare. It's getting more automated. I really love the time I got to spend with the grapple yarding crew, which is sort of like a very kind of old school way of logging. I'm sure they'll automate that even more soon. So that felt important to me, definitely. Just to sort of catch this these people in this job before it changes anymore. Or some of these guys are they're near retirement. Some of these, they've been at it so long, like almost 50 years. Some of these guys.
The automation is the thing that fascinated me, because there are photographs in the book of changes in technology, especially. I mean, when I think of forestry and I think of how they did it 100, 150 years ago, you know, I think of, old saws that two guys would pull, you know. But that's obviously changed a great deal, hasn't it? I mean, the number of crew members. That's gone down, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's shrunk a lot. I'm trying to think of, like, trying to get a rough number, like, probably when the family business with Eden River was logging in, say, the early 80s, I would say it took probably about 80 people to put, say, if anybody listens to this, they're going to probably think this isn't quite right, but it was basically, say, double the manpower. Mm-hmm. 40 years ago, to put the same amount of wood in the water, as they say.
When you there's a great part in the book where you talk about what it's like to work in forestry and how you view the logs themselves. For example, you start thinking of the trees as say you think, well, if we fall a tree, what that's worth. Like half a tree could buy dinner, five could buy a new jacket.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just a fascinating way to think about work itself. I mean, whatever work one does, you can quantify it, I guess, in some way like that, right?
Yeah, you definitely could, like, more so back in the day. That was sort of, like, specific to, like, talking about tree planting right now, which is, what you call piecework, so they're paid by the tree. I did this job where we were paid by the tree we cut down. And it does change your brain, and money is kind of cut out of the equation, and it becomes like this barter system in your head. And I would assume that probably happened probably more back in the day with logging, because fallers were on a paid by the tree scenario until the 50s or maybe even the 60s in some places. And I'm not sure about other aspects, but it was a lot more, and that really like lights a fire under you to get more done, and it also makes it a lot more dangerous. And it was risky, and it was difficult back in the day.
Yeah, you illustrate even just in your experience just how hard it is. You know, it does get hot in the summer. It does get cold when it's not the summer. It is an awfully wet work too, isn't it? Especially in British Columbia.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, quite a number of these guys are now, like, you talk about the automation, but it is done from the cab of the machine. But I did try to make sure to really drill down on those people who still have to go out and get out in the elements, because it's really ugly. As we both know, I guess, to be out there year round.
You also write about Haida Gwaii, and it's a place that too few of us have seen in person. It's such a special place for you. I love how your grandmother talks about it in the book. She talks about the reason why she stayed, and she cites the freedom, the wilderness, and the sea. And that's pretty much it, isn't it, even though it's more than just that.
No, yeah, no, you're right. That is sort of like when you pair it all back, that's kind of what it comes down to. And it's very early in my life, because my grandma, she lived there in the 60s and then moved back. Interestingly, I think that's such a common thing, like live there for a bit, but then you never really get it out of your system. So she was back living there through all the 90s and into the early 2000s. And yeah, she definitely summed it up well. And we visited her a lot when I was a kid. And it's funny, it's not very far from Prince Rupert. And like on paper, it's very much the same kind of place. But when you get there, it's really not.
And so when you're there and you're amongst the trees, I mean, you're across the country right now in Halifax, but I mean, yeah. you probably in your mind can still feel it and the physical awe, because you know you're amongst the trees and the sort and the smells even. I mean, those things still come back to you, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. I love stepping off the plane as soon as I get to Sandspit and just, yeah, breathing in the different air and get out in the bush. And I mean, I think, you know, people who haven't been around actual logging shows, logging blocks, the smell of wood is like, you know, take a lumber yard and times it by 100 kind of thing, in a good way.
I'll bet, like, yeah.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah. I also found amusing the when you'd make your way there and the plane had landed and you're looking for a ride into town, I guess, or wherever you need to go. And there's a couple of amusing incidences that you relate in the book to that. I guess that's a common thing, isn't it? Because when you arrive there, you haven't got a car, right?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on whether mom and dad were around. And it's I mean, amazingly, it's not very far as the crow flies, but it's like ends up being like a two-plus hour trip from the airport to Port Clement. But that's, yeah, that was also, yeah, that's nice you noticed that, actually, because that is a big slice of island life, too, is there's that sort of, like, hey, you going this way? Like, stick your thumb out, kind of ask around in the parking lot. Like, that's fine there. It's not taboo. It's yeah. Not, like, asking for change at an intersection kind of thing. It's just like, oh, this guy, you will help somebody if you can, basically. It's really nice.
Yeah, and then I forget how you describe it now. Your mom and dad weren't around to pick you up, and I guess there is a shuttle, but that can get full quite quickly. And
yeah.
I forget how you describe that shuttle, because it's for people that don't have anybody to pick them up, I guess, right?
yeah, that's what's known as the Nobody Loves Me bus.
Yeah. The trees themselves and how they're harvested, and obviously their numbers. I mean, this is something that you contend with throughout the book. Your dad does as well. And I found that fascinating, because that's best illustrated in the Haida and their relationship with the land itself. Because you do mention in the book there are few Haida that do the work of logging, and at a certain point in time, I guess this would have been in the 80s, their relationship with the land changed, and not too many of them pursued that line of work, right?
Yeah, it did change. I mean, you know, the 80s was kind of the end of the real high volume, you know, log off a whole mountainside kind of era. It was pretty crazy, the amount of wood they were taking out of there. And then, I think that a bunch of factors sort of came together to change the attitude of a lot of the Haida.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, actually. I wonder what will come in the future, because I do think it's, you know, as far as managing the land and stuff like that, like there's not too many places in the world, I think, that are more cautious or doing it better. But I wonder if it's not a popular gig for the Haida now, but maybe in another decade or so, another generation comes up and sort of sees, oh, like, you know, this is now being done sustainably in a way that, you know, I can abide by. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's at a low point right now. But I do think that it will, and there are still some in the business. And I mean, the biggest logging company on the island is Haida owned,
mm-hmm.
Not necessarily all Haida employees, but yeah. So it's I hope that it sort of changes back to what it was back in the day. Yet with the bonus this time of it being not being logged into oblivion.
Yeah, I guess we have learned, haven't we? Regardless of how we feel about resource extraction. That you have to do this sustainably, you have to do this responsibly, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's a real. It's tough though. Like it's easy to talk about, but like the how that sort of crunches out in everyday life is sort of like butting heads all the time. And how much do we take? And what why this valley and not that one? And who does the pipeline pass next to? That kind of stuff. Those are difficult debates.
Yeah, there are a number of scenes in the book where your dad as well, at a couple of them, go to these public forums where the community would gather, the Haida First Nation, obviously, and business and community leaders. And these are regular occurrences, as we read in the book. Your dad doesn't like those very much, or doesn't enjoy them, I guess, attending those,
no.
Right?
No, I think he doesn't like being in the public eye at all, which is also part of why he didn't want me. Well, I mean, it's fine now that it's out, but he likes to sort of keep to himself, which is funny because on a personal level, he's quite a a boisterous kind of life of the party guy, but he doesn't want to broadcast that worldwide. But yeah, he doesn't. He definitely was uncomfortable in that one that we attended together. If he can find a way to not, he definitely will.
Yeah, plus basketball's on, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he would much rather just go to work. And that's truly, I think I mentioned in the book, like that's all he would ever say. Well, we just want to go to work. And not deal with any of the repercussions or the blowback or anything.
Because
during his formative years, that was there was none of that,
right.
in the early 70s there was basically no organized environmental movement or anything. So during his formative years there was nothing like that to contend with, so that would be tough.
Exactly. I found those scenes interesting because they illustrate for a lot of us who live in the city, for example, what the community is like. You describe, these people coming together and all kinds of people, if you will, and people that work in the industry and don't, and yet they come together and after the discussion and the sort that, or there's a break for food it shows us what life is like there in a way.
That's something that really fascinates me as well. I think if there was anything that I kind of would sort of pull out of this book and work on another project, would be that sort of divide between rural and urban living. It's not just limited to those. You live in these tiny places where there's all sorts of political ideologies. Everybody has a different opinion. If there's an open mic night in Port Clement, you're going to see all stripes from the far left to the far right, and your options are to stay home and do nothing, or go to this open mic night where you maybe do have to listen to somebody that you can't stand play a song. So I really find that fascinating, and I think that's definitely something that I miss living in Halifax. I mean, I miss it at times, and I don't.
That's
double-edged for sure. Mm. Everybody knows your business.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned your dad, Kelly, already. He's such a fascinating character in the book. I mean, there are a number of memorable characters in the book, but I enjoyed reading about him and his work, obviously, and the relationship that the two of you have, because we see glimpses of it from time to time, we also see sort of the growth in him, as and we see how he views the world that's changing around him. And I found that interesting to read about. As a character in the book, was it easy to write about him? Because he does emerge as a character in the book and beyond somebody that you're related to.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. What was it like trying to put him down the page?
Yeah, and try to, because I don't want to presume that you got to know him a little bit better as a result of writing the book, but it seemed like you did as a reader. I found that.
I think maybe what happened more than getting to know him better was he did change in the course of writing, because it took me a long time to write it. I actually worked on it for 8 years.
Uh-huh.
And in that time, like, he was sort of starting to gear towards retirement, had some grandkids. The business took such a dive that I think that he felt for the people working for him a lot more, whose employment was more precarious. So, I mean, I think more than changing, it was more about how much he changed in the process of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was lots of stuff that I was hesitant to put in and stuff that I took out. I wanted to be really careful, and I think I did okay with that. But it was definitely a lot of humming and hawing, you know, over top of it, like at the keyboard, how do I say about Dad?
And the other thing that I thought was interesting was you talked to people that he worked with,
yeah,
and they would talk to him, talk to you about him, and sometimes what they thought of him surprised you.
Yeah, for sure. Because I worked for him when I was a kid and stuff. He had a little interlude from when I was 6 to 16-ish where he ran a concrete company.
Uh-huh.
And so I worked for him at that, and it was very tough. He was, as my mom would say, he was a bit of a slave driver, work was always so serious for him, and so to hear these guys kind of say, "Oh no," and certainly there were guys out there who didn't much care for him.
Sure.
But it was nice to hear, and I suspected as much. He's pretty competent, or very competent, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Very good at what he does, and I think there were guys who appreciated that he had a plan, that he wasn't logging camps, logging shows can be pretty disorganized places. So it was nice to hear that he was appreciated by some.
Yeah, and then near the end of the book. He goes back to some of these places that he went to 50 years ago, 50 mm-hmm. or more years ago now. And I found that quite moving because he's recounting what it was like to get there for the first time and realize, you know, that this was going to be a place where he was going to spend a lot of time. Well, maybe he didn't know it then, but you know, obviously he spends a lot of time there. And in a way, you're seeing him as a young man, aren't you?
Yeah, totally. That was really interesting. That was the very last chapter I wrote, and it also came together pretty last minute. That was last September, and it was great. And that's exactly what you said. Like, it was sort of this. I sort of saw him and his career with new eyes. This place that had been so special to him. He'd lived there from a teenager to his almost 30. That's a good chunk of a very important time of your life to spend, and to spend it in the bush in the middle of nowhere. Not too many people will have that experience anymore. And I think that when he looks back on it, it was mostly a good one. And it was so neat. He has trouble with all those names and stuff, and then suddenly we're there, and it's just like every spot was a memory.
The other thing that I enjoyed about the book a great deal is your interactions with people. As we talked just before we started, I've been doing this for a while, and I'm always fascinated by how other people connect with other people and how they get them to tell them stuff. And you it seemed to have that great ability to do that. Because you're talking to a lot of people who probably don't spend a lot of time reflecting about who they are or what they do. How are you able to elicit what you get out of them, saying, because we end up reading about such memorable characters that obviously takes a lot of work, and I'm wondering how you're able to do that.
Well, that's a nice thing to say. Thank you, Joe.
You're very welcome.
But I don't know. I think, like, everybody has an ego, but I try to sort of put that aside if I'm talking to somebody. I think that a big part of it is that I respect so much and admire so much some of those guys that are still doing that kind of work, like a guy like in the book, Evan Forger is a good example.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's in a way it's almost like meeting your not quite heroes, but I guess in a way heroes, like those to me, those, like, you know, sort of regular working with a regular working person kind of thing is a real romantic figure to me.
And is it because you work with them for a bit that they're able to talk to you as openly as they do?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that helped a lot. I mean, I don't know much about logging compared to these guys, obviously, but I do know enough. I mean, it's such an esoteric sort of thing if you can talk to somebody about cubic meters of wood or how much, you know, what was stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think that means a great deal to them. If you can learn a bit of the language, that goes a really long way, I think.
Yeah, even the scenes where you're here in Vancouver and you're down there in by the Fraser River, you know, and all those places down near Marine Drive, I guess, or south of Marine Drive, where all these warehouses and factories or whatever you call them, and you're talking to these guys who are in the business, and you illustrate who they are and what their personalities are like so vividly. We can't help but see what these guys are eating and or how they eat,
right,
in the cafeteria.
It's funny. I really like those guys too. It was a different sort of. It was a really different side of it.
Yeah.
And I remember I showed somebody like an earlier draft of the book, and they're kind of like, these are just businessmen, you know, not interested. I was like, no, I really like these guys. They're really, it's fascinating. Yeah.
Your own growth is something that we read about in the book. You don't talk about it too explicitly, but you do mention it from time to time. I mean, we do realize that it's a number of years it's covered in the book. I can't remember who it was now that you're talking to. When you're writing about them, you mentioned that when you first met them, you know, you were just a kid, I guess, and then over the years, you have kids of your own now. And I found that interesting because I'm talking to you now. You live in Halifax. A number of years have passed by since this all started, right?
Yeah, a good chunk of it was written before I had any kids, and it definitely changed my viewpoint. We just had our third kid, our third and final, and I think that, you know, in that instance you're talking about, some stuff happened in his life that I couldn't really fathom until I had kids of my own, and that's, you know, talk about connection points and stuff like that. That's, you know, a big one for you know, many people. Not everybody is having kids, but yeah.
Yeah, the that person you were talking to, I found that quite a moving scene, because you knew him for a long time, but he obviously didn't talk about the family challenges that he'd had, and
I hope that was okay. I mean, I sent all that stuff to him before it came out, and I didn't really hear back specifically about that, but anyway, that was another one of those sensitive ones where it was like, do I put it in? Do I take it out? And I hopefully it was handled the right way.
Well, I think it's your compliment that he would tell you that stuff, I guess. You know what I mean? And
yeah, but then it's sort of the journalistic conundrum of, like, you know, you tell me your story. Thanks, I'll broadcast that to the world now for my game.
This speaks to your talent as a storyteller, because I read a review of the book this morning, and the reviewer compared the book to Ken Kesey's book about forestry, and it even
a great notion. Yeah.
And then he also compared you to Haig Brown, which
legendary. That was very kind.
What is it like now that the book's out and people are reading it and you're getting, say, not just reviews like that, but you're hearing back from, say people that are in the book even?
Oh, well, it's like a long, lonely process it was to put this together. And so I think that it's really nice overall, I guess, is the short answer. And I definitely wanted to do right by the people that I'm close to, and I think the other pleasing thing overall, everything's very nice. The other thing that has pleased me is that it seems like even people who are you know, more environmentally minded, maybe even more anti-logging, kind of accept it as, okay, like, this is a portrayal of you know, this industry, and it's you know, passes in their eyes too. So that's the nice thing. I had that in mind.
Aaron, do you wonder what the forestry industry, especially in British Columbia, because this is what we're reading about in your book, will look like when you're your father's age, say?
Oh, I think it will be even more heavily second growth logging.
Uh-huh.
As far as tech goes, like, who knows? But I think that some stuff will probably be done remotely pretty soon. Maybe stuff is already being done remotely and I'm not even aware of it. I just picture it looking a little bit more like the Scandinavian countries, where it's just more plantations and it is more farm-like overall. Which is great in a lot of ways. It's kind of too bad that those sort of Wild West sort of, you know, glory years are over, but that wasn't going to stick around forever.
This might be a better question for your dad, but I mean, when we think of old growth versus second growth, you'll forgive my ignorance, but I guess the quality of the wood is different, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. And if you leave second growth long enough, it matures into really nice timber, and then the benchmark for the coast being 250 years, it's been classified as old growth again.
Yeah.
The issue right now, I think, and a lot of loggers think, is that it's being logged too quickly. So if we could, you know, if something's being logged at 60 years, we should be leaving it for another 20 years so that we get a lot more value out of it. I think that's sort of the emerging issue with logging second growth.
And what is it like, I mean, to see the rings? When you see these logs cut down and they're on the side of the road, say, or they're being picked up, or they're in the back of a truck, and you're seeing these rings, because we all know what those rings mean. What is it like for you to see that? I mean, it must if I saw that, I'd probably pause for a bit and look at that for a while.
Yeah, it is kind of a similar feeling. You might, as you went into like a really old cathedral or something, I don't know. Like, there is, it does emanate this sort of heaviness or something like that. You just, like, you're looking at these rings where you can get over 20 rings to an inch on a tree that's, you know, 4 or 5 feet in the butt, and it's just like, it's kind of mind-boggling.
So I've mentioned a few times now that you're I've reached in Halifax today. What brought you out east?
It was just kind of accidental. I did my undergrad out here in Newfoundland, did a journalism degree in Halifax here, and while doing that degree, my partner Sue got a job in the oceanography department, and here we are still.
Yeah. And did you get out here? Did you get out to BC a lot, or?
Yeah, I do, actually. My the sort of ace in the sleeve is that I work at Air Canada as well, loading and unloading planes, so I get the flight benefits to come out. Not too much with the kids now, but we make it generally two trips a year for sure, and then I'll often do a couple more on top of that.
Are you working on another book now?
No. just had the baby 8 weeks ago. I hope that something sort of, you know, comes into view on that end. But for now, it's fine. I'm fine taking a little break. But I want to do something else for sure.
Yeah, it's such an enjoyable book, and I was quite moved by it, and I laughed out loud a couple times. I can't wait for the next one. Congratulations, Aaron, on the book and everything else. I so appreciated your time today.
Okay, yeah, thanks very much, Joe. Appreciate it as well.
The book is called The Last Logging Show, A Forestry Family at the End of an Era. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its author, Aaron Williams, joined me on the line from Halifax in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.